we're looking at 1 to 3 years worth of global emissions. The scale
Sorry,
of this.
Can you repeat that? So if we're looking at those prospective resources, that's not just more than any country, that's worth more than the total global emissions.
At the maximum estimate of how much gas there is there, it would be more than 3 years worth. That's right.
Of global emissions.
Of global emissions. And we're talking more emissions than any fossil fuel company has historically emitted from its fossil fuel operations since 1988.
That's mind-boggling.
And one for mum, one for dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The treasure.
Australia's basically done for. It just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and we're recording this on Tuesday, the 22nd of September 2020. Today, Angus Taylor, the Energy Minister, unveiled his inaugural Low Emissions Technology Statement. That was at the press club. And unsurprisingly, for a government that's been unable to stick to an energy or climate policy for more than a few weeks at a time, it was reasonably low on details, heavy on fossil fuels, and missing anything about renewable energy. And of course, we still don't have the tech roadmap, which is yet to be unveiled.
Which it calls a technology investment roadmap. $18 billion of Commonwealth investment will focus on
clean hydrogen, batteries, green steel and aluminium, carbon capture are among them.
Roadmap exactly how it would bring down emissions.
Promising to save 250 million tonnes a year by 2040 without harming the economy.
Of our emissions reduction agenda that will strengthen the economy and create jobs, leading to the development of the technology investment roadmap.
It's been talking about every single technology except renewable energy. There are other really weird things in this roadmap. Why is nuclear power in, but bioenergy is not? How on earth do you describe energy efficiency as an emerging technology? Why is there still not a plan for electric vehicles?
This looks more like a mud map leading us off a cliff than it does a roadmap. There's no date for emission reduction. There's some unicorn technologies in there like carbon capture and storage that we've...
The Australia Institute says $1.3 billion in government investment has gone to CCS, but there is not one, in their words, commercial CCS facility for coal in Australia. Are they right?
There isn't one single commercial CCS project in Australia right now.
The other thing is, look, I think we should get out of the Paris Agreement. We've got to stop the rubbish here. The Paris Agreement was made in China.
Now, I realise that we here at Follow the Money just did a two-part series on gas, but it seems like all the Morrison government can talk about lately. And since those episodes, Angus Taylor has announced more cuts to the funding for the Australian Renewable Energy Agency. He's announced intentions to pollute the investment mandate of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, which at the moment is a profit-making investor in renewable energy, but he's going to turn it into a potentially loss-making fossil fuel project investor. The Prime Minister has declared that, quote, gas has chosen itself, but it's probably more accurate to say that Scott Morrison's hand-picked gas executives picked gas. And the government itself has pretty much all but anointed the gas industry as the second coming of Jesus in its efforts to throw money at the industry. So to unpack the scale of the problem that the government is creating for Australia by investing in the gas industry so heavily, I'm talking to Richie Merzian and Tom Swan from the Australia Institute's Climate and Energy Program. G'day, Richie. G'day, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, cheers, Ebony.
Hey, Eb.
So, Richie, I'll start with you. Just to recap quickly, the government says that it wants a gas-fired recovery. What does it mean by that?
So the government has decided that the best way to address both the COVID crisis and the climate crisis is to increase Australia's reliance on fossil fuels. But coal is no longer the fossil fuel of choice. It's old hat. It's also higher polluting just on a very simple like-for-like basis. And so it's now moved towards natural gas, and it's looking at how it can expand Australia's natural gas supply, its reliance on natural gas for electricity, as a feedstock for industry, and how we could use gas to potentially build other fuels like hydrogen. And it's done all that with the help of the gas industry, which seem to be populating almost every government advisory body right now.
History's also shown us that you don't tax your way out of a challenge like this. Australia can't and shouldn't damage its economy to reduce emissions.
So, Tom, we've got a government that's looking to massively expand the gas industry, but just how big is the Australian gas industry?
Australia is already the world's largest exporter of liquefied natural gas. We're one of the world's largest gas producers overall. And we've actually been most of the world's growth in LNG in the last decade. Three quarters of our gas is exported. So it's already a massive industry. And the government's looking at supporting a pipeline of projects that would see gas in Australia expand even further.
And Tom, you recently completed a report for the Australia Institute, I think commissioned by the Australian Conservation Foundation, which looked at the emissions from gas. What does this massive increase in the gas industry mean for Australia's emissions?
Let's start with gas as it currently is in Australia. The gas industry is heavily polluting, even putting aside the fuel. So obviously it's a fossil fuel and you burn it, creates emissions. But even putting that aside, it's very energy intensive to extract gas and to export it. Already, gas in Australia is responsible for 10% of our emissions. That's just producing and exporting the gas, including the LNG trains, which themselves burn enormous amounts of gas, more than double the amount of gas burned in Australian households. So most people are familiar with gas from their stove and maybe their heating, but more than double the amount of that as used in Australian households is burnt by the gas industry itself just to export the gas. And then on top of that, you've got the problem of methane emissions. So methane is the main component of natural gas. It's a huge greenhouse gas in its own right.
It's more potent than CO2, isn't it?
It's much more potent. But also in the near term, over 20 years, it's much more potent. And when you look at a reasonably small amount of leakage or venting, as they call it, it can massively increase the climate footprint. According to some studies in the US, looking at their shale fields, which is really what the government's trying to replicate here, the amount of leakage basically doubles the climate impact from gas. So when the gas industry says that it's actually a cleaner fuel, they don't want you to think about the methane emissions that we're really not measuring properly and not accounting for, which make it possibly worse than coal.
Well, as we know from Donald Trump in the United States, if you don't test, you won't find cases. Does that mean if we don't measure it, we won't find methane emissions from the gas industry?
Oh, it's so simple. I didn't think of it that way.
So, Tom, tell us about some of the projects that are in the pipeline.
So what we did in our report is look at the major projects list of new gas projects around the country. There are 22 currently in the pipeline. These are a huge range of sizes and types. The biggest ones are all offshore in WA, but there are really projects all over the country. And so there are 22 of these. In addition to that, we looked at shale gas frontiers in the Beetaloo Basin in the Northern Territory and the Canning Basin in Western Australia. Both of them.
What do you mean by a frontier? What does that mean?
These are basins where there's potentially very large amounts of gas in the ground, and governments and companies are incredibly excited about exploiting it. But we don't really know yet how much there is how much it's going to cost to get it out. So there's still exploration underway and no specific projects proposed. But governments have and companies have put some big numbers on the table. So we put this all together and added it up, and we found that the total amount of gas production in the pipeline already is more gas every year than currently exported from Australia. So we're already the biggest LNG exporter in the world, and the pipeline is even bigger. So it's simply an enormous amount of gas, and that's not even including the gas that is still in the ground waiting to be tapped into.
And how much is left in the ground?
That we've found, or companies have found, what they call identified resources. This is five times larger than what Australia has already extracted and burnt so far.
So everything that we've extracted and burnt so far, like in our history,
yep,
what's left over is five times bigger than that.
Yeah, already. And so we know that most of what we know is there has to stay in the ground, but companies and governments are already looking for even more. So this goes to the Beetaloo Basin, and in particular the Canning Basin in WA, which is just staggeringly enormous. It's mostly shale gas, which is similar to what's happened in the United States. And if we look at the scale of these basins, we're talking about volumes of gas that are globally just staggeringly enormous, and the emissions, of course, are as large.
You mentioned in your speech that this plan is going to help create around 130,000 jobs by 2030, but given that state governments and the private sector and others are going to have to provide some of the funding to get there, can you actually guarantee that that many jobs are going to be created, and when will you release the modelling showing how that figure is reached?
So, to your question about the jobs creation, we're talking about $18 billion of investment from government, and based on our historical track record, we are very confident we can achieve upwards of $50 billion of total investment. Now, we know that has the potential to deliver 130,000 jobs. It's a phenomenal investment in our economy.
So, Richie, I think in the past have talked about gas, that Australia has overtaken Qatar as the largest exporter of gas. But, you know, how much will this change Australia's gas industry if we go down this path?
Australia's gas industry is often overestimated in terms of its employment size, in terms of the income it brings. Yes, Australia exports more liquefied natural gas than Qatar, but Qatar, which is a country of 300,000 people, makes something like $26 billion from the amount of gas it sells, and Australia makes a few billion. So the way it's even structured is Australia doesn't really take advantage of all these resources, these finite resources that it's extracting. Going down the path that Tom's just outlined would only just further exacerbate these problems. It's the capital-intensive, jobs-poor sector that doesn't really pay much in terms of what Australia does and also increases our emissions. So it would just put us into more of a bind rather than less.
I mean, I just find that staggering that Qatar brings home something like $26 billion from its gas and we're only pulling in a couple. But sticking with that and what you've just talked about there with it being a jobs poor industry, I mean, the government is talking about this in terms of the recession, in terms of being a good stimulus, but apart from being jobs poor, you're essentially saying that we're not even pulling in that much from, in terms of revenue from the gas industry compared to what other similar nations who export gas are pulling in for their taxpayers.
No, the Australian government is really bad at getting money from the multinationals that are extracting our gas. Like, they have been quite successful at shifting that profit overseas. And Chevron, one of the big multinationals, was actually successfully prosecuted by the ATO because it was shifting profits through exorbitant interest rates to its headquarters so that it wouldn't have to pay anything to Australian, to the Australian government. And so this happens right across the board and we all suffer.
And is there anything to indicate we're going to get any better at collecting tax from kinds of revenue?
No, if anything, we will get worse. I mean, it's obvious how deeply embedded the corporate influence of the gas sector is in federal politics with Nev Power and Andrew Liveris, like appointed and
Grant King,
and now shaping our national policy. Just today, this new technology advisory council that Angus Taylor has made permanent has two gas executives on it and no one from the renewable or clean tech space. This is a council for the singular purpose of lowering our emission through technology, and they have two people on there who have increased our emissions. The other two, there's someone from the soft drink industry and someone, you know, and a big banker. Like, it's like the setup of a joke rather than an actual, you know, collection of our best minds to shape how we reduce our emissions.
Ebony, if I can jump in there, there are really sort of two factors in why doubling down on gas right now is a terrible way to increase revenue in the future. One is that the government's talking about subsidizing it. Well, if you subsidize something, you're going to lose money. But also the industry is itself, in economic terms, is in real dire straits. We've had a historic collapse in oil prices. Gas prices are linked to oil price, lost enormous amounts of value. We've seen projects delayed, not cancelled, but delayed. And so there's from a financial and economic point of view, we've got huge amounts of capital at risk. And what does the government do at this point of historically low prices? It talks about subsidising yet another gas boom. It's simply economic lunacy, even putting aside the climate implications, which are, of course, extremely serious.
Given Mr Power's role with Strike Energy and Andrew Liberis's role on the board of the Saudi oil and gas company, can you tell Australians that no one on that commission stands to personally gain from the plan that they recommended to you?
Well, I can tell you that the plan that we've announced today is our plan. It's our plan. The government makes the decision. Yes, we...
So getting back to those climate implications, Tom, can you just put the emissions from gas into a bit more context for us? You've talked about, obviously, how much bigger it will be and how much is left in the ground, but how does it compare to other countries, for example?
Right. So what we did in our report is look at the emissions implications from the project pipeline. And if all of the gas is burnt according to how the Australian government thinks it will be, the projects in the pipeline would be most of Australia's national emissions. Of course, with leakage, it could be much higher, and we could be looking at something close to Australia's annual emissions. But wait, there's more. If we look at the resources in the ground, all of the identified resources, and we put a match to that and burnt it all, that would be greater emissions than any country annually.
Well, including China and the United States.
Including China, absolutely, every single country. And if we talk about the prospective resources, that's the shale resources like in the Canning Basin and the Beetaloo Basin, where very furious exploration is currently underway, we're looking at 1 to 3 years' worth of global emissions.
Can you repeat that? So if we're looking at those prospective resources, that's not just more than any country, that's worth more than the total global emissions?
At the maximum estimate of how much gas there is there, it would be more than 3 years' worth. Yeah, that's right.
Of global emissions.
Global emissions. And we're talking more emissions than any fossil fuel company has historically emitted from its fossil fuel operations since 1988.
That's mind-boggling.
So the scale of this is just enormous, and it's something that clearly, from a climate point of view, simply cannot be allowed to happen. Now, the gas industry likes to walk both sides of the street here. On the one hand, it loves to talk about burning it all. And on the other hand, it responded to our report by saying it was intellectually vacuous, which I take as a badge of honour from the gas industry. They said that, of course, it won't get anywhere near that big. Well, if the gas industry would like to tell us which parts of the gas resources will stay in the ground, that'd be very helpful, so we could settle that and move on to aligning their expansion projects with the climate goals. The science is very clear. We have to leave most of it in the ground. There's no way around that.
It's like a new gas reservation policy, Tom.
Interesting.
But solar, wind, gas, coal and hydro are all mature technologies. They're already cost-competitive sources of energy and don't require significant public R&D investment. If there are major new breakthroughs emerging in these technologies, we'll consider them, but that's not the focus at this point.
I also have noted a bit of a change in the government's language, Richie, where all of a sudden solar and wind are mature technologies. What does that make gas? Geriatric?
Look, it depends on the day of the week that you ask the government. Last week on Tuesday, it was talking about how solar and wind are mature and don't need any more subsidies and they should get by themselves. And then on Thursday, it's talking about gas getting a full subsidy, the taxpayers to come in and build a new power plant running on gas, even though that technology has been around much longer. So it's technology agnostic when it comes to renewables, and it's picking favorites, or probably more accurately, picking losers when it comes to fossil fuels.
Yeah, it'd be one thing to pick a winner, but to pick a loser is pretty,
The minister managed to contradict himself on this even just today at the press club. He said, on the one hand, it's a mature technology and doesn't need support. And on the other hand, he's talking about recovery. They're really all over the place.
Mm.
And it's clear that it's just about suiting the sort of political rhetoric that they need to push ahead with the subsidies they want.
Given the Black Summer bushfires that Australia has just experienced and the summers of disasters that we've had in previous years, all fueled by climate change, How dangerous is this plan to kind of double down on gas? First to you, Richie.
It's really dangerous. I have far less confidence in Australia's ability to address emissions after the last fortnight than I've had in quite a while. Like, the technology investment roadmap isn't something that the UN or anyone has asked for. The government's picked this process because it is politically useful. But it doesn't do the one thing it's supposed to do, which is reduce emissions over the next decade. Instead, it turns to more fossil fuels. And so the only policy that the government is relying on right now is to use these dodgy Kyoto carbon credits to offset the increased emissions over the next 10 years. Tech roadmap won't do anything over the next decade. There's no emission reduction numbers over the next decade. Instead, we just get more pandering, more support for the fossil fuels, be it directly through gas power or indirectly through these sort of falsified definitions of clean, like clean hydrogen. So feeling a lot less confident than I was before.
Tom, what about you after that summer of bushfires where, I mean, we're all here in Canberra. We couldn't leave our, you know, houses for weeks on end. We had the worst pollution anywhere on Earth for a number of those days. It was quite apocalyptic. Yeah. And there wasn't even, you know, bushfires on our doorstep at that point. I mean, what's your assessment of this path?
Yeah, you're right, Ebony. It was a pretty scary time. And I look to what's happening on the west coast of the United States right now, and it's exactly the same thing. And, you know, we know that this is going to get worse. We know that summers are now longer than they used to be. We know that temperatures are going up. We know that wild weather is going to get worse until we get emissions down to zero. That's physics doesn't negotiate. That's what the science is telling us that we need to do. So I'm terrified by that, and you know, we have to keep pushing for what we know we need to do. But it's not simply a disaster from a climate point of view. It'll be a disaster from an energy system point of view. So we can trust this tech roadmap, which our FOIs have shown is based on thought bubbles dreamt up in the energy department, with the transparent and rigorous modelling process gone through by the Australian Energy Market Operator. When they look at what we need to do for lowest cost transition, it involves a lot more wind and solar and a lot less gas. And so by supporting this more expensive technology, we're not only increasing emissions, we're also basically stuffing up our energy system, making it more expensive for consumers over coming decades.
So in summary, it's going to waste a lot of taxpayers' money. It's going to drive up emissions and help fuel climate change, and investing in gas won't really produce that many jobs. Is there anything good to come out of this?
The only good thing is that coal is no longer really on the horizon. Like, we've picked a less, you know, big loser. It's like the biggest loser, and coal is the biggest loser. And now we're on to the next one.
You're not getting anywhere on coal, though.
Well, I'll just keep up the fight, Peter, mate. I think it's important to stand for what is right.
Except, of course, Richie, that when you include the methane emissions from unconventional gas, it could well be worse than coal. The science on methane gets worse. Every study that comes out with worse figures on how much it heats the planet, how much is being leaked. The satellite imagery is really scary. It's not even clear that especially unconventional gas is cleaner than coal.
And you had that new Bloomberg article as well about the mines, the gas wells that are just leaking and being unattended. So yes, maybe we're the losers here.
Well, on that cheery note, we might wrap it up there. Thanks very much, Richie and Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ebony.
This has been a special episode of Follow the Money, and we're aiming to bring you shorter but more frequent episodes during the pandemic, so please stay tuned. And I don't know about you, but I found that discussion profoundly depressing, so we might try and find some good news to cover next week to cheer us all up. I know I could sure use it. You can check out the Australia Institute's Economics of a Pandemic webinar series. That'll cheer you up. That's at our website, tai.org.au/webinars, to register. They're all free, and I'd love to see you there. For the latest health information, you can check health.gov.au or listen to the ABC's excellent CoronaCast podcast, which comes out daily. For all our latest research and content, including Tom's paper called Weapons of Gas Destruction, you can visit tai.org.au, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Richie Merzian is at Richie Merzian, and Tom Swan is at @Tom_Swan with a double N. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. Keep washing those hands. Stay safe, everyone. Stay 1.5 metres away. Thanks for listening.